Hello and welcome to another of our podcasts about the Mayflower and Britain. If you've not come across our project before, we're a group of historians and literary studies scholars funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, and we're interested in exploring the cultural afterlife of that most famous of 17th century voyages and how the memory of the pilgrims was expressed in things like art, literature and monuments. Today we're going to talk about how the Mayflower was commemorated in one particular location, the Hampshire port of Southampton. So not everyone actually knows that the Mayflower had originally left Southampton in the summer of 1620 with another ship, the Speedwell. Unfortunately for the pilgrims, the Speedwell quickly began to take on water and both ships had to turn back several times. Finally, in mid-September, they abandoned the unseaworthy vessel and set off from Plymouth on just the Mayflower and for the last time. 66 days later, they arrived at New England on the eastern seaboard of the Americas, and they established a settlement at a place that had already been fortuitously named Plymouth some years earlier. So if you were to go down to Southampton's Western Esplanade today, you would be able to see the city's memorial to the pilgrims. Made out of Portland stone, it rises about 50 feet from its base to a shimmering golden white glass cupola, and then perched on top of that cupola, there's a copper weather vane, and this portrays the best guess at the time of what the Mayflower might have actually looked like. Today, this pilgrim memorial is probably not the best known monument in Southampton. The cenotaph designed by the famous architect Edwin Lutyens is better known, as is the Titanic Engineers Memorial. There are also plans at the moment to erect a Spitfire Memorial. The early designs for this suggest that it will tower above all of the other monuments in the city. But if we go back to 1913, when the Pilgrim Memorial was put up, thousands of local people crowded the streets to catch a glimpse of the ceremonial unveiling. So clearly, for people at the time, this was an event of considerable importance. So in the rest of this podcast, we're going to explain when and why people in Southampton became so interested in celebrating the story of the Pilgrims, and how they went about expressing that interest too. To really understand the desire to memorialise the Mayflower, we have to first go back to the late 18th century and the other side of the Atlantic. In 1769, members of what was called the Old Colony Club began gathering in Plymouth, Massachusetts to celebrate the arrival of the Pilgrims in what they called Forefathers' Day. Not long after, another society based in Boston and called the Sons of Liberty caught on to this new tradition. For the Sons, the purpose of Forefathers' Day could be revolutionary, an opportunity to whip up support for a New England breakaway from the British Empire. Either way, there was the beginning of a growing sense that the Pilgrims symbolised everything that was great about the new nation, ideas of liberty, freedom and belief. In 1820, on the 200th anniversary of the Mayflower's arrival, the American statesman Daniel Webster gave a celebrated speech that brought these ideas to a new mass audience. It went down very well in the US, but there was no mention of it in the British press. But within a few years, the knowledge of the Mayflower story had begun to grow in Britain anyway. And we think a key player here was not a historian or politician, but a poet, Felicia Hemans. She had come across some evocative reports of Daniel Webster's speech and penned her own most famous work, The Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers in New England, published in 1825. Hemans used a lot of romantic and emotional language to get her point across. Lines like a stern and rock-bound coast, or woods against a stormy sky. This gave a sense of drama to her poem. But she also differentiated the pilgrims from other colonial adventurers by saying that they did not seek bright jewels of the mine or the spoils of war, but simply the freedom to worship God. The Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers in New England sold thousands of copies on both sides of the Atlantic and was rarely out of print for the next 100 years. Most importantly, it was a key vehicle for people in Britain to link the image of the pilgrims to contemporary values like piety and bravery. So people in Britain were now curious to learn more about the pilgrims and to begin this process of claiming them as examples of a pioneering English spirit, in a way, taking them back from the United States where they were much better known. By the midpoint of the 19th century, the pilgrims then were starting to crop up across the country and in a variety of different contexts. The most famous romantic poet, William Wordsworth, was using them in his work. Charles West Cope, a painter, put them in his intricate murals that went in the new House of Commons in the 1850s. And in various churches and halls, particularly those of the religious nonconformist group, the Congregationalists, there were the erection of Mayflower stained glass windows. So from being an almost unknown story at the beginning of the Victorian period, poets, politicians and pastors now had in common this new desire to celebrate the pilgrims. One of the most important shifts, however, took place towards the end of the 19th century, and this was when the British and American versions of the story began to link together. Back in the past, because of the American Revolution, continuing conflict during the American Civil War, among other things, the relationship between the two countries had often been sour. But time was a great healer, as was British support for the American War with Spain in 1898. Old wounds were beginning to heal, so what better image to evoke the coming together of mother and daughter than the historic ship that sailed between the two? Up until this point, Southampton had actually pretty much forgotten that she had played her role in this historical event, and there was barely a mention of the voyage made before the 1870s. But now, visiting American dignitaries were landing in Southampton's harbour, taking in their sights on the way to high-profile diplomatic events in London, it seemed like a good time to start remembering. So as an example, picture the scene in 1885. The newly appointed American minister to Britain arrives at Southampton on a huge steamship. But rather than letting him dock, a gaggle of members from the town council, in full robes and chains, sail out to meet him on their own boat. They then bring the American minister aboard, where he could not fail to have noticed the many stars and stripes hung around him. Southampton's mayor gave him a hearty welcome to the shores of England before another member of the council party prodded the minister and asked him to turn his head to see the spot from whence the Mayflower sailed. So we can see from this event that interest in Southampton was clearly beginning to grow. But it wouldn't really be accurate to say that most people, or in fact very many local people at all, knew much about the specifics of the Mayflower story at that time. But that was arguably not the case in Plymouth, much better known as the final port of departure for the Mayflower. Already in 1874, Plymouth's mayor had paid for a stained glass window of the Pilgrims to be put in the town's brand new Guildhall. 20 years later, the town council had also placed a small memorial tablet in the pavement of the harbour, stating quite simply, Mayflower 1620. Back in Southampton, the newspapers saw what Plymouth were doing and were actually quite open about showing their annoyance. So I'll read out a quote from an anonymous author in the Hampshire Advertiser, popular local press at the time, which demonstrates how people in Southampton viewed Plymouth's claim to Mayflower importance. Plymouth, as the Advertiser put it, had commenced agitating their port as far back as the days of the Pilgrim Fathers. Their rivalry, or more strictly speaking jealousy of Southampton, is of ancient date. There was not a single Plymouth or Devonshire man on board the Mayflower, and the whole of the little band came from Hampshire and adjoining counties. Is it dignified for Plymouth to carry on in this way? So it's worth saying in relation to this quote that, in reality, very few of the Mayflower's passengers actually came from Hampshire, or in fact even nearby, and only one, a young man called John Alden, had any connection to Southampton at all. Alden had been hired in the town to be a cooper on the ship, but even then it's possible that he was not from Hampshire either. So it was hardly fair of that newspaper to suggest that Southampton was above the sort of commercialism they were accusing Plymouth of, when they were also so eager to claim the Pilgrims for themselves. But as the century came to a close, Southampton's reasons for making more of their links to the Mayflower started to become more clear. As steamship travel improved, so too did the economic fortunes of the town. In 1893, the American line began shipping into the port. The White Star line followed in 1907. And finally, in 1919, Cunard too. Put simply, it made good business sense to flag up Southampton's pedigree of transatlantic voyages. Like we still see with companies today, there was a sort of cultural capital in making a claim that the port had long been servicing the needs of adventurers and traders. So, when a local historian suggested in 1909 that he thought the town should erect its own monument, a whole host of local businessmen and town councillors quickly jumped on board. Like the mayor said, it was amazing that an event of such eminent historical importance should have been left so long without any memorial in Southampton. So the mayor took it upon himself to write to newspapers across Britain and America, to wax lyrical about what he called the increasing number of bonds linking together in amity and respect the peoples of New England and Old England, and even more widely, the nations of the British Empire and the many states of the Great Republic of the West. So this sort of rhetoric that Southampton's mayor was using was quite attractive to American diplomats. So the American ambassador of the time, when he was asked to come and lead the ceremonial unveiling of the Finnish monument in 1913, quite happily agreed. For both Southampton's elite and American diplomats, cultural links like the Pilgrims were a romantic way to evoke the growing Anglo-American alliance. Of course, when the Americans entered the First World War in 1917, the Mayflower was a go-to propaganda symbol. People like the great poet of Empire Rudyard Kipling, among other writers and propagandists, took to describing the American intervention as the return of the Mayflower. Not refugees sailing back to the old world, but soldiers imbued with the same belief as the Pilgrims in freedom and liberty. And, as luck would have it, just 2 years after the Declaration of Peace, it was the 300th anniversary of the Mayflower's voyage. In 1920, in the shadow of the war, this was a great opportunity for places like Southampton to celebrate both their historic and present role in Anglo-American relations. The whole town was heavily decorated in the flags of both countries, and the Star Spangled Banner and God Save the King rang out. Parades, carnivals and swimming competitions were popular events, but by far the most impressive was a historical play, or what was called a historical pageant at the time, performed on the quay in front of the now auspicious Pilgrim Fathers Memorial. This play was dubbed, quite simply, John Alden's Choice. A mammoth cast of 450 local amateurs took part, and at least 8,000 people saw a performance. This play was symbolic of the enthusiasm for links between Britain and the USA, and the attempt to put Southampton at the heart of a much larger international story. So humorous history, but also the pathos of the present, were entwined in a narrative that covered 300 years of history. The storyline began on the town quay of 1620, with locals watching the Pilgrims preparing to leave the country. John Alden was played as something of a local rebel, and at one point was even locked up in the town stocks. So the choice referred to in the title for Alden was a simple one. Should he stay in his home country, or should he join these pious yet adventurous religious settlers on their journey to the New World? John didn't have to make this decision on his own. A mystical fortune-telling gypsy appeared to offer some help. She showed Alden the unfolding of the American future, the negotiation of peace between Native Americans and the Pilgrims in 1621, the Boston Tea Party in 1773, George Washington's presidency in 1789, and Abraham Lincoln on the eve of his great Gettysburg Address during the American Civil War. John Alden realised that, at this point, if he left for the New World, he would be part of a chain reaction of events that would lead to the breaking away of the American colonies. But when the gypsy then finally delivered a vision of the United States coming to the aid of Britain during the war, Alden swiftly changed his mind. As the pageant programme put it, any Englishman would have made the same choice, not only from pride in the great future of the country to which he was sailing, but also from affection for that country which he was leaving. So Southampton's experience for this great tercentenary celebration in 1920 was quite representative of how the Pilgrims were beginning to be understood in Britain in the early 20th century. There was a serious message behind these sorts of commemorations, a desire to remember historical forebears who had gone on to do great things, but also to put them to work for diplomatic and political purposes in the present too. But this didn't mean that people weren't up for having fun. Dressing up in period costumes, acting out the past, these were a great part of the attraction of the Pilgrim story. An interest in the Mayflower stayed strong in Britain in the following decades too. Monuments began to appear in other places, like Immingham in Lincolnshire on the banks of the Humber estuary, and plaques were put up on the homes, schools and churches that survived of the most famous of the Pilgrims. In the early 1950s, a plan was even hatched to retrace the voyage with a replica ship. The Mayflower II, as it was called, was the brainchild of an ambitious and erudite Fleet Street publicist called Warwick Charlton. Charlton had seen action in the Second World War and wanted to acknowledge the contribution of his American comrades. By 1956, he'd raised enough money to see his dream become a reality as a wooden ship started to take shape in a small Devon shipyard. Next year, a hand-picked crew, led by the Captain Alan Villiers, successfully sailed to the east coast of the USA, where the modern-day pilgrims were met with great fanfare by thousands of excited spectators. But back in Southampton, the local MPs were upset that the city had been bypassed. Only Plymouth, as the final port of departure, had made it into the itinerary of the Mayflower too. So in a way, this was just like the complaints that had been made over 60 years before when Plymouth had pipped Southampton to the post with the first proper memorial. When the 350th anniversary of the voyage came around in 1970, something similar happened again. Putting up £100,000 to ensure the grandest celebration in Britain, Plymouth positioned their city as the most important place in the story of the Mayflower. Southampton didn't go down without a fight. The city's mayor at the time went on television to battle Plymouth's own mayor in a sort of civic debate about which port was the most important. Lots of other less adversarial events also took place in Southampton to mark the occasion. There was an exhibition of historical documents in the Maritime Museum, a glossy illustrated pamphlet produced that detailed episodes in Southampton's past, and a procession to the memorial, complete with historical reenactors. Probably the most popular event was a final fireworks show in the Mayflower Park, witnessed by thousands of people. But we think surely the most fun was the invention of a Mayflower cocktail by the Barman's Guild. If you want to try and mix this up today at home, the ingredients were mead, whiskey, and ginger ale. For a time after the 1920 commemoration, it had seemed like Southampton had forgotten the pilgrims. In the 1930s, the creation of the Western Docks had cut off the memorial from the water, and the growth of car traffic after the Second World War left it sandwiched between the old town walls and a busy road. But if we go from the 1970 commemoration up to the present, we can see how developing ideas of heritage and local belonging had kept the idea and the memory of the pilgrims alive in the landscape of the city. From Mayflower gyms and roundabouts to the famous Mayflower Theatre, there are many reminders in the landscape today. So I hope this whirlwind march through the last 200 years has explained why the 400th anniversary of the voyage is being celebrated in Southampton. If you'd like to find out more about pilgrim memory in the city, we've also written a longer pamphlet that you can pick up from the Hampshire Field Club and Archaeological Society's website. There is also more information about our research and the many other commemorative Mayflower events in Britain on our website, which you can find at www.voyagingthroughhistory.exeter.ac.uk. Thank you for listening.